Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 325 of Registry Matters. Larry, I got a funny for you, real quick.
There's no such thing as a funny from you.
Yeah, not in my vocabulary. So the transcript last week, when I said it, I said 324. The transcript comes out 300 24. And the transcription person, even the temporary one, completely botched the whole job and just left it there.
That is not funny.
See, I don't find anything you do funny, and you don't find this funny. Anywho, how are you tonight?
Doing very well, thank you.
Fantastic. Please head over and show love and support. Like, subscribe, 5-star ratings. You know the drill. Supposedly, Larry, if you hit the bell icon on YouTube, it really makes a difference. That's what they say. So please go over there and do that. Please, pretty please, with sugar on top. And if you would be very generous, you could go over to Patreon and show support there for even as little as $1 a month. That would also be fantastic. You can listen to us cut up and do the show live, and then you can hang out and talk to Larry afterwards, because that's what everyone is there for. They don't want to talk to me. No one wants to talk to me, Larry.
I wouldn't go that far.
But not far from it?
Not far, but not that far.
What are we doing tonight?
Again, it's just you and me, Mr. Gloom and Doom. So we plan to take a look, kind of a deep dive into a case in a trial court in West Virginia. It's a very sad case for me, and I'm sure for the audience. Also, we have what will probably be a brief segment on entrapment with an expert as our special guest. But unfortunately, we weren't able to get enough information for our expert, so I bet we're going to be coming back to this in a future episode. And then we're going to be teasing again about the upcoming international travel episode that we're working on putting together. And we have a listener comment to read. And there are no articles for this episode, so let's get going.
All right. Well, then I will just straight up introduce, pretty much from memory, my good friend Kathleen. I can say your last name. I mean, you've been on the Dr. Phil show. Probably your name's out there, right? Holy moly. Did she already drop off? All right. Well, Kathleen Hambrick is joining us and is our resident expert on all things of police stings and fake entrapment kind of things. So just to get things going, and then I will get comment from Kathleen after I read this opening paragraph, is would you set this up real quick, Larry, of what this is?
Okay. This is a submission on the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers listserv, which I'm an associate member. And we post questions and answers to one another. And this is an attorney who posed a question. And I cut and pasted the question that he posed about entrapment. And it caught my interest because this is a big boogeyman for me about entrapment. And it's a prevalent practice in states and federal, including my state here. And I knew that we have this expert that has been successful in fighting an entrapment conviction, and I thought, well, this is something she might be interested in. In my mind, we're going to have a lot more information by today, but we don't. But we have a little bit here. So that's what you're reading as the attorney's original posting, and then one response that came in after you go get started.
Very good. All right. Well, it says, hi, team. I am considering a motion to dismiss for outrageous government conduct in a federal sting case. Client is charged with use of a facility of IC to, is that intent and something?
Interstate commerce.
Oh, interstate commerce. Okay. To persuade, induce, etc., a minor to have relations. The person on the other end of the chat was an FBI agent posing as nanny to an 8-year-old whom the agent herself claimed to want to seduce. Wow, that's kind of a stretch. Over the course of their chat, agent sent 3 or 4 pictures of a fully clothed, smiling 8-year-old. Agent also sent photos of herself. I'm still trying to determine whether the child in the photos is an actual child or AI. I've seen many of these stings in the past, but not where a picture of a child was sent. If the child was a real child, the potential for judicial disgust seems much higher than it would be in the ordinary sting case. Would like to know whether anyone has encountered this situation before, and if so, what did you do about it? Hey, thanks. So, Kathleen, do you have insight and comments on how this would go forward?
Is that for me? Sorry.
Yes, yes, it is.
For me here. I'm going to talk now. So, I would say there's a lot of things that this this person needs to find out. Of course, the pictures of children are allowed if they are pictures of police officers who have given them to be used for these stings. It cannot be a picture of a real child that is not involved. So I doubt that that would be the case. And I'm not sure what their stance is on AI. I imagine those would be allowed because they're not real children, so they have no rights anyway. But there's a lot of things that would be questionable in this. I'm not sure that a motion to dismiss for outrageous government misconduct would get anywhere. We've seen in almost every case that I've seen, they've tried to do that. So it's almost like, you know, how as soon as the sentence comes down, the attorney is asking for reconsideration. It's almost a procedurally done, but does rarely resolve in anything coming of it. We've seen outrageous government conduct in practically all of these sting cases, so that's not surprising. But whether or not this was an 8-year-old child, I don't think is the real kicker here. The things that caught my eye would be that this person is claiming that they want to seduce this child, and they're asking if this other person would want to do it with them. For me, that's minimalization and making it kind of encouraging them, saying, well, we're doing it, so do it with us. And that is not allowed. That's a plus factor. So what happens when there's an entrapment case is that the defense has to show there's a plus factor, meaning that they more than just had the opportunity, that they were encouraged to do this. And that would be a plus factor to say that they wanted to seduce this child and could you do it with me? But if they've never even talked to this child, then we're going on the intent. And then I was just talking with Larry about there are some changes for the rules for intent as to whether or not those apply for different sentencing guidelines. But that's kind of past this. We need a lot more information on what actually happened here. It sounds like this attorney did not get the full discovery yet. And until they do, I don't think they should make a move, actually. But that's my position. Larry, what do you think?
I tend to agree with you on this. One thing that I would like to ask your question about, and this is totally cold because we didn't prepare questions, based on you having sat through a trial, and I've sat through two trials on using an entrapment defense, do you think it would make any difference with the jurors whether it was a real child or a make-believe child in terms of raising this defense? Because that's...
And you cut out there.
Do you think it would make any difference if it was a...
Andy, can you say what he said? I'm sorry, I couldn't hear you, Larry.
Keep talking there.
Okay, I'm not sure who's supposed to be talking.
I was asking you to continue
your thought
process.
Sorry, guys. My connection's really bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I don't know if you can hear me better. He's asking, do you think it would make a difference if it was an actual child or if there was a fake, whatever, if a non-existent or an AI child?
With the juror.
With the jury.
If it would make a difference. If it really was a... Yeah, if... Oh, with a jury. If it was a real child... That would be a nail in the coffin for the defendant, in my opinion, because as I've seen in all of these cases, if they send a picture, it's a picture of a younger police officer, and they're clearly not the age that they've said, such as in my own son's case, they said 13, but she was really 25 in the picture. Okay, that's a big difference. If it really was an 8-year-old and it looked like an 8-year-old, then that would be bad to go to trial with, in my opinion.
All right, and then there was another attorney that responded to the original request, and then we'll get comments from Kathleen after that. Separate from outrageous misconduct, I'd consider seeking to dismiss on the theory that the defendant did not attempt to persuade or induce a minor, but only prepared to attempt to. Asking my friend's wife if she knows if he's busy next Friday because I want to invite him out for dinner is not inviting him to dinner, nor is it attempting to. The law in other circuits is bad. I guess that's the California 9th District, Larry?
Correct.
Okay, so CA9 recently joined the party, but perhaps you can make some headway factually. To my surprise, because the agents manipulate the client so the facts are not pretty, I succeeded in getting a judge to dismiss a case in this posture. I'll send the briefs.
Okay, so what that points to me is about substantial step. He's kind of saying that he talked about it, but he didn't do anything that indicated he was going to do it. Substantial step. And so what I've seen in a lot of these cases is whether you go or not, the police are still coming to your house and arresting you. I think personally that that's a lot of leverage, just as this attorney is saying. That doesn't mean you were going to do it. It just meant it means you talked about it. I do know a guy in Washington State who he did not go to meet up with the person. He, in fact, went to a party and on his block. The cops came and arrested him, and he did get off with, I know he had to do some education and really small amount of probation. So by the scale of these, they're still going to charge you. They're still going to try to get you to take a plea deal, but it's definitely to your advantage to have not gone. And that's what it sounds like this attorney is saying. If he only talked about it, there are ways to make that leverage.
What do you have to say then, Larry?
Well, I hope we can get a little bit more information and on this listserv. It's always sketchy in terms of the information because they've got client confidentiality.
Of course.
But I could refer this attorney that originally posted this. I could hook Kathleen up because I can't think of a more determined, dedicated, and wise individual to have fighting this battle. And I've, like I said, I've done 2 jury trials, and we lost both of them. And we did one in Albuquerque and one over in the rural part of the state in Clovis. And it makes no difference. The juries don't give a damn about this, and we've not been able to gain any traction. So I would like to, if Kathy would want me to, I could say, hey, I don't know much about this, but I know someone who does. I know that we've lost these cases when we've put them on trial.
Kathleen, do you want Larry to send you over as a referral, perhaps?
Of course. I'm always happy to talk about this. It's a huge part of my life. And since I was fortunate enough to be instrumental in a win, whew, thank God, I would love to pass on what I've learned.
So
that'd be cool. Larry, can you remind me, like, you know, pretend that I have a pea brain, which I would say I have a pea brain, but we talk about cases where a person has standing, and if there's no victim, then who has standing? I'm really puzzled by that.
Well, the statute in a criminal case is derived by the standing, I should say, is derived by the statute. So the prosecution is putting forth a criminal complaint based on citing to a statute. And so it's assumed that a statute is constitutional upon enactment. So therefore, the standing is that the prosecutor alleges on or about this date these things occurred and within the jurisdiction of the court, and this person did these things. So the court has to at least initially take the case until motions are made. And that's what this attorney was asking. Is there any pretrial motion I can make that might get rid of this case? But the standing is the state. It immediately has standing if you're prosecuting for something that has been defined as a crime by the people.
So meaning like the state versus, so they have the standing because it's the state versus John Doe or whatever?
That would be correct. They automatically have the standing because the people have told them. It's kind of like way back when we first met, we had a discussion about a president whether or not he has to get a national security clearance, and they do not because the people give them the security clearance.
I remember that.
Yes. Well, the people have given the state the standing that it needs by the enactment of the laws.
Interesting. Kathleen, any closing comments? And then we'll let it all go and move on.
Not really. I just sincerely apologize for my bad connection, but thank you for inviting me to give my opinion.
Thank you so much, Kathleen. Really appreciate it. I'm going to mute you and we will move along. Thank you again so much. I'll add some contact information at the end when we get there. Can you email that to me while we're doing this and I'll make sure to throw it in at the end? And so, all right. Well, then we have this little kind of like new thing that came out in the last, like, I'm looking at the article. It came out yesterday. And here's a CNN article that says, Crystal Magnum, who accused three Duke lacrosse players of rape, now says she lied. So, kind of, you know, along with that same thing, we've received a comment from a listener that says, I'm only sending this because, well, it's rare that a media outlet actually reports on false allegations. I find it as somewhat a validation of Larry's statements about everyone deserves the benefit of innocent until proven guilty and why the victims' rights groups are truly flawed in their thinking that we should default to a guilty mindset based on an allegation alone. This woman's claim destroyed not just these three boys' lives, but all the other players on their team, the entire student body, lost out on revenue that season, and the coach lost his job. This, to me, is the epitome of what Mr. Doom and Gloom says is among the most rational and important voices among our advocates. His honesty needs to be listened to. Larry is saying what needs to be heard as we approach these situations.
I could not figure out who sent that. I had an email address, but whoever it is, if you will send another one, I will send you a payment for that.
I didn't realize that you had people on the dole.
But here's what I would say in response to that. Thank you for the really kind comment. But try to maintain intellectual honesty. When you don't like someone, be sure that if you believe in a presumption of innocence until proven guilty, you even believe in it when it's someone you do not like and you find despicable. Because if we're going to be consistent, it means that anyone who's accused of a crime, regardless of how outlandish the evidence may seem up front, we should take the exact same position that the police take when one of their officers is accused of something. The police have a standing line that they say, well, you've only heard a little bits and pieces and you've seen stuff taken out of context. They will say that. They'll say, you've only seen this one sliver of a 20-second video. Well, that holds true for everybody. When you hear someone's being arrested and you see that ugly mugshot and you hear all these outlandish things that they purportedly did, that is just a part of the story. Always, always assume that the person is innocent and that there's something that in their defense posture that they can put forward that will either mitigate those charges or totally do away with those charges. Never assume a person is guilty. And that's really hard for people to do consistently.
Do you have any idea of how we arrived at the guilty until proven innocent mindset?
Well, it evolved through, God, we're going to go off on a political tangent, but it evolved, in my opinion, through grandstanding politicians who realize that they can get elected and they can have tremendous support. There was a confirmation process not that long ago where there was a lot of grandstanding for a Supreme Court justice. And
pretty sure I know who you're referring to.
And it's easy to go out and say, what about the victim? What about their rights? That resonates with almost all the population. When you go out and say, what about the accused and the suspects? What about their rights? That doesn't resonate nearly as well. Those seeking office have used and exploited this by putting forth victims' bills, Bill of Rights, and all this stuff that they've done to diminish what we can do to defend our clients. That it's evolved over time. It hasn't been anything, one thing overnight, but over time, more and more things have been stacked up against us so it's hard for the accused to get a fair trial, and the last vestiges are being totally dismantled with the statute of limitations. You can't get a fair trial with something that's 40 or 50, even 30, 20 years old. And I say the exact same thing, whether it's someone I like or don't like. We had a conversation about a person in Alabama named Moore. You remember that episode many years ago?
I believe so, yeah. Oh, yeah. You're talking about the dude from Alabama, right?
Yes. When he was running, he was a former Chief Justice of the state Supreme Court, and he was accused of, decades later, he was accused of having inappropriate relations as a young man with someone at an old Hickory House restaurant, I believe it was. And I said, as much as I don't like Roy Moore, wouldn't vote for him for dog catcher, he is to be presumed innocent. Those charges should not be brought against him decades later because he can't get a fair trial. You know, that old Hickory House has been closed for 30 years. Everybody's disappeared that would be helpful to his defense, and he could never have gotten a fair trial. I didn't pick and choose who I was defending. I don't need to like Roy Moore. I don't need to like his politics, but he's entitled to fair treatment under the law, and he's entitled to the presumption of innocence. I wish my kind friends on the other side of the aisle would say the same thing, but most of them don't. They magically think if it's someone that they disagree with, that they're guilty.
I'm just trying to see how we would have ever gotten there. Like, isn't the Black's Law book? What is that thing called?
You know, Black's Law Dictionary?
Yeah, I mean, isn't that where the rather one innocent man, I can't remember what the expression is.
I don't think it came
something about how many people go free versus one innocent being found guilty or something like that.
It didn't come from there. Somebody that I can't recall was quoted as saying that in our founding fathers document somewhere along the line. But it's better that we have innocent roaming free, that we don't want people in cages for something they didn't do. As an honorable society, you should never want anyone in a cage for something they did not do. I'd rather have five people outside the cage that did something than one inside the cage that didn't.
Yeah, totally. All right, well then let's move over, Larry, to this really tragic, messed up disaster in West Virginia. And did you want to set it up for our fine folks?
Sure, but I'm going to tell you on this one, you can certainly go off script as you need to. I've set up a script, sure. But this one is going to be so disappointing that you're probably going to want to go off the script, but I can set it up. It's a disappointment is understatement. This is about a college student from Maryland who was attending a prominent university in West Virginia, and he got arrested for filming minors in a restroom at a high school sporting event in West Virginia. And I did everything I could to sanitize this for no name. So if there's a name on the screen, if it's not one that I've substituted for a real name, please ignore it and don't give a name. But I did substitute the name of the parties. I've put in substitute names for them.
And did you say he did what I think I heard you say?
Yes, unfortunately, you heard correctly.
And you were asked to help out on the case?
Yes, I was asked.
Okay, and so for the purpose of the segment is to form others who may be in a similar situation so they can make hopefully better decisions. Now, would you tell me who reached out to you?
The accused's mother contacted me through Narsal. And let's refer to the accused as Bob and the mother of the accused as Beth. Beth hired an attorney in West Virginia, and she also hired an attorney in Maryland. And that sounds good so far. What'd you ask us for your line?
I saw that. So do you agree that that is how things were going?
Yes, that is good so far if she hired a competent attorney.
Now, if we're back to the same question and we've had for years, how would she know? How do you judge if an attorney is competent, particularly for this kind of thing? You'd have to find, it's not an ambulance chaser where there are a dime a dozen. I'm sure criminal defense attorneys are pretty common, but when you move into this arena, now you've moved into a pretty high degree of specialty. So how do you know if your attorney is competent?
That's a good question. And she wouldn't, unless she was a legal professional in the legal profession, or she calls someone like me that could help. But what I would encourage you to do when you're trying to answer this question is, when you're looking for that attorney, just because they say things you don't like does not make them a bad attorney. And that's too often the disqualifying condition. But go ahead.
No, I mean, so I thought you said she did contact you.
She did. And unfortunately, I worked pro bono, which probably rendered my analysis and advice unworthy of consideration.
Why is that such a thing, that if you give, like, if it's free advice, it might not have, must not have any value?
I don't know why pro bono is not worth anything, but it's been my experience that people don't value it as much as they would if they paid for it. But I did try to help as best I could.
Now, I'm beginning to get the idea that this did not end very well for this case.
It did not.
And so if we try to keep this as much of a PG family program, might we dig into some of the details then?
Sure.
Was it a negotiated plea?
Yes, this case was resolved by a plea.
All right. And you've pontificated for years that too many suspects sink their own ships by talking to the police. Now, did that occur in this one?
It did. It did very much. He not only talked to the police, but he signed a full confession. And this is not uncommon for a first-time offender. Middle-class families teach their children that the police are to be trusted because they're their friends and their protectors.
And since that's true, what do you think that they should do instead of?
Well, I would say you take that Miranda warning that they read you very seriously, and you do not speak with any investigators unless you have a competent attorney present.
Wait a minute, we're back to that.
As again, sorry. You may not know that they're competent, but at the very minimum, you need to ask them to see their bar card, because I've heard horror stories that police that are not on the up and up have an imposter pose as an attorney. I've not witnessed that.
What? Before. Really?
I've heard of that.
And would that then hold up in court?
I don't know. I would think that it wouldn't if you could prove it was not a competent attorney, but the police would be disingenuous and they would never admit that they would say, well, we've got a legal person here. They would tell a story that would not, they would not admit what they did.
But I would also have to think, Larry, just on that one little point, that almost any attorney would be able to guide you through not sinking your own ship this way. I gotta think that just about anybody, even the person that barely graduated out of law school, would be able to cover you in this with the Miranda rights and stuff like that. I gotta think that that would be true.
You're probably right. They would be able to. But what if they're in collusion with the police? And
that's an entirely different story. I got you there.
But yes, they should be able to say, I'm advising my client not to talk, and we're going to conclude this interview. That's what any attorney should say in that scenario.
But what if they tell you that I'm here to help you? Remember that whatever Reagan said, we're the government, we're here to help. No, the hell they're not. Things will go easier on you if you cooperate with the investigation.
But they are telling you the truth. Things will go easier if you cooperate, but unfortunately it'll be easier for them and not for you.
Let's go take a look at the plea offer.
Yes. If you don't mind, can you read the opening paragraph and the first five numbered paragraphs, and then we can go through them as need be.
Do you want me to forward down to the plea agreement? Is that where you want me to go?
Yeah, if you can read.
Okay, I got you.
I'll try to hold your spot here so we can find it again.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app. Hit the subscribe button and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, And there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. All right, well, it says, I, the defendant, will enter a plea of guilty to use of minors in filming naughty stuff, a felony as charged in court one of indictment. And then I, the defendant, has been informed that the penalty for use of minors, blah, 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 is a fine of not more than $10,000 or imprisoned in the penitentiary not more than 10 years or both fined and imprisoned. So you either get A or B or A and B. That's great. The defendant will enter a plea of guilty to the things that I'm not really interested in saying over and over again, a felony as charged in count four of the indictment. Then the fourth one, how far did you want me to go? All of them?
No, through number five.
Okay, so we've got two more. All right, this is number four. The defendant has been informed that the penalty for use, blah, blah, blah. I'm sorry, that was number four. So number five is, the defendant will enter what is commonly referred to as an Alford plea, pursuant to North Carolina versus Alford, blah, 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 a bunch of court citations, and will not be required to give a factual basis for his plea of guilty to the thing that he did, a felony as charged on counts one and four of the indictment. Good?
Good.
Okay. Where are we at? I'll catch up. Go ahead. I gotcha. Thank you. So what is so significant about these specific paragraphs then?
The significance of those paragraphs is that he is being offered a plea to serious felony charges. And this begs the question of what he is receiving in exchange for that plea.
He's also getting an Alford plea? Doesn't that have extra bonuses for being a first-time thing?
No, doesn't have a damn thing to do with anything.
Oh, what am I thinking of where you do... Is that where you... I'm not going to be able to pull that out of my butt that fast. So what do you think he would expect to receive otherwise?
Well, he would expect to receive some concessions at sentencing that would serve to limit his exposure. The only limiting factors in this plea offer is that they're agreeing to dismiss some of the counts. Now, that is a concession. But since I'm not on the defense team, I do not know how strong those counts were. If they couldn't prove them anyway, it's not much of a concession. But there is no agreement in terms of sentencing. This means the court would have no limitations other than the statutory maximums, which you read in those paragraphs. You read the statutory maximum for that count is 10 years or $10,000 or both. So that means by virtue of this plea agreement, on that one count, he's opened himself up to 10 years worth of exposure.
I gotcha. And the agreement indicates that he could get up to 10 years on count one. So what was count one?
That was the use of minors in filming sexual explicit conduct. And what they could impose for that is the 10 years that we talked about. And what I'm already have been troubled about is I'm not able to imagine what the sexual explicit conduct would be in a bathroom. I mean,
you are so naive.
Okay, we're at a high school basketball game, and there's adults and security and all sorts of people. What would be going on in a bathroom that you could be filming that would be sexual explicit conduct, that you'd be using minors to do that? It would sound like to me you were filming somebody at a urinal taking a pee-pee.
That's that could be enough for some people.
So, all right. Okay, now can you go ahead and read paragraphs 6 through 10?
Absolutely. All right, so the defendant will enter a plea of guilty for possession of material depicting minors in blah, blah, blah as a felony as charged in count 8 of the indictment. How many accounts was he being indicted on, Larry? You know?
There was 8 initially.
Okay, all right. And then, so that was number six. Number seven is the defendant has been informed that the penalty for possession, blah, 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 is imprisonment in the state correctional facility. Ah, it doesn't say penitentiary on this one. A state correctional facility for not more than 2 years and fined not more than $2,000 or both. And what's a state correctional facility versus a penitentiary, Larry?
Not being familiar in West Virginia, I'm assuming it is for less serious offenses and they're not sent into a full-blown prison. It's a correctional facility that would be for less serious offenses, something between county jail and the full state pen.
All right, so that was six. That was seven. So I got a couple more to go. Number eight is the defendant will request alternative and concurrent sentencing. The state will take no position as to that request and does not object to the defendant's use of the treatment programs, the scam treatment programs that PFRs go through by Dr. Charles Reeducated. Really? The guy's name is Dr. Charles Reeducated? Seriously?
That should be redacted.
Oh!
That's intended to say redacted.
That's funny. That's a really funny typo. All right. On May 3rd, 2024, to satisfy the requirements for eligibility under Virginia Code, the state's position is conditioned, however, on the defendant's continued compliance of the following items until the sentencing date: that he has no further direct or indirect contact with the victims in this matter, that he submits and passes random drug screens if requested, that he has no violations of any criminal law, and that he maintains full compliance with all scheduled hearings and probation appointments. The state will make no request at sentencing for an affirmative finding under West Virginia Code, subsection 15122A. That was finishing number eight. Now, number nine. The parents of the juveniles named in the indictment will provide a victim impact statement and sentencing recommendation to the court. And then finally, number 10. The defendant will be subject to registration requirements and extended supervision as required by West Virginia Code, blah, 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 same thing as I read before. And then another one, 62-12-26.
I think it should have said subject to registration, not suspect, but okay.
I could have completely botched my reading.
So
it does say subject.
All right.
Anywho.
So I'm guessing you want me to explain these now that you've read them, right?
Well, why else would I have read them except for to have the explainer in chief explain? So explain.
Okay. So the paragraph six indicates he'll plead guilty to count eight as well. And this count, as you articulate, is possession of material depicting minors in sexual explicit conduct. I have additional trepidation about this because I'm not sure that any sexual explicit conduct was going on. I don't think taking a leak is sexual explicit conduct. But this count carries a maximum of 2 years in prison, which is what I would rather have him pled to rather than the other count. But under this plea agreement, his exposure is now for a total of 12 years, and he's at a huge risk unless the state has agreed to a cap of his exposure or to a probated sentence.
Is that because he could have these run consecutive?
Correct.
Okay. Wow. Now, do you think that probation was ever going to be on the table as a viable option?
No, it was never a viable option, in my humble opinion.
Of course, Mr. Doom and Gloom is here. Now, why do you feel that probation was not an option at all, period?
Now, we can go off script a little bit on this for a number of reasons, but primarily, he is not from there. This is a person who is an outsider, and he doesn't have any favors to call in. And there's no reason for a judge or prosecutor to be lenient on a person from another state. And his conduct is very distasteful to most average citizens. And that this plea agreement left the judge with untied hands, and it left opportunity to be tough. And when you have to run for re-election, it's nice from time to time to say, I'm a tough sentencing judge. And I didn't see probation as being an option without more specificity in the plea agreement, because knowing how the system works, we got serious charges, we've got a yuck factor, we've got an out-of-stater, and I just didn't see that as being a viable option.
So what was the sentence then that the kid received?
He received a 10-year sentence, so he did. He didn't get the max, and he has to serve 5, according to mom. And that is such a disappointment. I'm not surprised, but I'm disappointed because she spent her life savings and mortgaged the house.
Oh, Jesus!
To get to this.
And do you have any inkling of the dollar figure?
Well, I threw numbers out trying to milk it out of her, and she didn't object to the numbers I threw out. But I would figure that for the West Virginia lawyer, it was probably $50,000 minimum. And for the Maryland lawyer that was going to help him ease into Maryland on probation, that was his role or her role. I don't know the gender, but that was his or her role. I suspect that she paid anywhere from $15,000 to $25,000 for the Maryland attorney. So I'd say she's got anywhere from $65,000 to $75,000 invested in this.
And is it fair for me to ask, do you think that they milked her knowing otherwise? Do you think that the attorneys were naive? In like, it would be nice if you go in there and you lay out what this case is and they're like, look, man, let me go in there and do the best I can. They're going to get screwed, and let's call it $25,000. And I'm not going to try and fight. I'm going to try and contain damage.
Well, that is not the best posture to take when you go in there, but there's a little bit of wiggle room in that posture. You want to go in with something, and he reduced the something quite a bit by signing a confession and talking to the police that took that out of our playbook. But there's other things that weren't out of our playbook, and that's mental disease or defect. Apparently he's autistic, and apparently he has some physical health problems. And we would go in, and what I would do is I would look at the law very carefully in West Virginia, if I'm not from there, and I would figure out if we could do anything, gain traction with a mental disease or defect offense. Because if you gum the process up and you make them work for it, they're more likely to negotiate. It's just the opposite of what you think would be the case. If you go in with humbleness and saying, what can you do for me? They don't have any reason to do anything for you. They've got everything they need. And it's a secure conviction and prison time. But if you make them work, they're just like everybody else. They don't want to work because we don't want to work if we don't have to. So I would have said, well, you know, I guess we're going to be doing a full psychological workup. I'm going to ask for a mental status evaluation. We may have to commit him to the state hospital there. You know, this is going to take a whole bunch of time. Counselor, what are you looking for? Well, I'm looking for some serious negotiations in terms of an outcome that I can live with, that I can present to my client. But I can't, I'm not going to plead him straight up and down in the indictment. You guys are going to have to work for that. Well, counselor, we've got a full confession. That's nice. But I've got tricks up my sleeve as well. And you're going to have to work for that. And so that's the posture I would have taken.
As I understand it, you communicated with the defendant's mother multiple times?
Several times, not multiple times. We had one telephonic conversation and a few email exchanges.
I see. And her final communication was 2 days prior to sentencing. Can you read that?
Yes, you can read that. I'm not really wanting to read it because I think I'm going to break down when you read it. But this is really
okay.
So she had this question she posed to the team before that she went in for the plea, and then she had the devastating news about it. So this one's not the worst one, but this one was letting me know which way it's heading, which way this case was going.
All right. Well, she wrote, "Hello, I'm back with another important question. I need some help. We go to court Friday," which is yesterday, correct?
Correct.
Correct. So we go to court Friday in West Virginia, and while we are transferring everything to Maryland, so even as of leading up to yesterday, she thinks that he's just going to get some kind of probation and move. Transferring everything to Maryland where we live, the attorneys are saying that we have to enroll in probation in West Virginia first? Question mark. I thought that probation would be in Maryland, not transferred to Maryland. Is there a difference? I feel like someone advised me to avoid stopping in West Virginia, but they are saying we cannot avoid that. It's clear that she was expecting that he would receive probation.
It is exactly, that's what she was. And that's one of the tragedies of this case, because she, I believe, was misled by the attorneys. They should have never told her that probation was a viable option. What you would tell the client is this: probation is a long shot within the contours of this plea agreement. I'm going to write the best sentencing memo I can possibly put together, and I'm going to make the most stellar arguments I can make. But please be prepared that he might be let off in handcuffs, and that's a real possibility. That way you can say your goodbyes, you can hug your son, and you can realize that this is more likely the outcome.
Hey, was he like held in lockup during this process, or was he out on bond or whatever?
No, he traveled in from Maryland.
Okay. Because that would be another thing, at least on the defense side, of like, you don't have him in custody at the moment. I'm not saying you can't go get him easily, but if you just have him and he's just squandering away in jail, that's a pretty miserable place to be. And you would kind of rush things so that you're not stuck in that miserable place.
So, but yes, I think she, I think she was misled by her attorneys.
I gotcha. And she had multiple ones. She had two attorneys.
Correct. He had an attorney in West Virginia and one in Maryland. And also she was consulting with an attorney in North Carolina, and she was consulting with me.
And in the email exchange, it doesn't seem that neither of them are exactly sure about her questions.
Yes, these are the same attorneys who didn't understand how the interstate combat works and weren't able to advise her, on the off chance that he received probation, how the interstate combat will work. I find that totally disgusting that you can take this kind of money from someone and you can't go find the bench book and read the rules about interstate combat transfer for PFRs. You ought to have your bar license revoked.
And now that he was sentenced yesterday, can we discuss what happened there?
Yes, but make sure no names. This young man could be in danger due to the yuck factor of his convictions, and I hope I didn't let any names slip through.
I didn't see any. I only remember the names at the beginning. Hell, I don't even actually know the names, honestly. So it seems, though, that I guess this is a letter from her. It says, Larry, unfortunately, your prediction was correct. While we agreed to the plea agreement with the prosecutor for probation, in the end, the judge sentenced Bob to 10 years with a mandatory 5 to be served in West Virginia prison. They took him to the sheriff's office to be transferred to jail, the one where he already spent 11 days, and the guard threatened to kill him. The prosecutor and judge felt he was a high risk for reoffending and did not see the autism as an excuse or mitigating factor. Bob was obviously a mess. We were all a mess. So he is so vulnerable and scared. He sleeps with a pillow pet, and I'm sure he will be abused and taken advantage of. Our hearts are broken, and because it was a plea deal, we cannot appeal. It is our worst nightmare. Meanwhile, he also has a hemochromatosis, which I have no idea what that means, and needs a phlebotomy on a regular basis. And I just don't know what to do. It is a tragedy.
Yes, it is. So, we're actually going to talk again tonight after I finish with the podcast. And we're going to explore options. And the options are very limited at this point because, as she pointed out, the plea agreement has closed many doors. Did you attend a conference that NARSOL did where we had an attorney from Georgia named Bill Quinn?
That's before my time.
Okay.
Well, I believe.
Mr. Quinn is retired now. And
I know the guy.
He is a very competent attorney and worked his behind off for his clients. I called him right before we went live today, and I asked him if he knew anyone in West Virginia that was of the caliber of himself, and he does not. But if I could find someone like him that would actually do the work under my supervision, of course, I think there's a glimmer of hope, but it's a real long shot. It would be like the case that we did, Quinn and I did together, of the PFR that was convicted in Georgia, and he served his prison sentence, and then he contacted me to try to get back to Texas for his probation or parole, whichever it was, from Georgia. And as I started digging into it, I said, "Hell, you shouldn't even be convicted." He says, "What do you mean?" I said, "Because you're incompetent. And the evidence clearly shows that you're an incompetent person then, you're an incompetent person now. And you should have never been put on trial because you were never
caught." Didn't he have, like, memory issues?
Oh, he had been disabled by the, he worked for one of the major oil companies, and he was not the floor sweeper. He was a supervisor, and they forced him to retire because of his mental condition about 10 years before this happened. So we had solid medical evidence, and he was acting a nut in the court. And that's what I caught on to because of some of the stuff I read in the transcript. I was reading the transcript, and I said, I can't believe. I said, the judge didn't suspend this proceeding with you saying the goofy shit that you said? And he said, no. I said, any judge should have stopped the proceedings and called a sidebar and said, counselor, why is your client responding in such a manner? He came back late for lunch. And he told the judge he was late from lunch because he had to take his little green pill. And the judge should have said, well, what was that pill? What does that pill do? And he would have told him it was a psychotropic drug. And he would have said, time out. You're on psychotropic drugs and we've got you on trial here? But he didn't do that. And so we were able to get in a habeas proceeding where we're able to get a judge pro tem because the judge up in, I even think the Forsyth or Cherokee County, that judge recused himself. And we don't know why, but he didn't want to hear it. And we ended up with a pro tem judge that was from Muskogee County over in Columbus. And the pro tem judge didn't have any dog in the fight. The pro tem judge looked at the medical evidence we had. And Mr. Quinn went out to Texas and got some fresh evidence and updated and talked to his doctor. And we had fresh evidence on top of the old evidence. And the judge pro tem said, hell, this guy's crazy. And we said, yeah, that's what we've been telling you. So,
hey, Larry, we got a medic in chat and says hemochromatosis is a genetic metabolic disorder which causes excess iron in the blood. And he says essentially it's the opposite of anemia.
That is what I had read this morning when I Googled it. He has to have that removed. Oh. And they're not going to do anything. He's 24 years old now. They're not going to do anything for him. They're not.
Yeah.
And I hate to tell him, maybe they're not going to do anything for your son.
And so then I'm wondering, does he just suffer? Well, is he in a life-threatening position for 5 years? And he'll have to end up, whatever the symptoms would be, does he like face plant and they have to take him to medical and do whatever they do, and then they'll put him back in a general population?
Well, I don't know enough about the medical aspect, but I know this. They're not going to do anything until he goes into whatever period. He has to decline to the point that he's on the floor, and then they might take him to medical. But as a 24-year-old, when you say you need to see the doctor, they look at you like you're nuts.
I'm with you. He's responding. I was trying to like create enough padding there to get there. How do I ask this the best way? Are you at risk for criticizing the attorneys?
I'm willing to take that risk. I think this case was not well handled, and I'm willing to take the risk of them not being happy with me. I'm not happy with them.
Yeah, sir. Yep, but they have all the letters, Larry. Just saying, they have all the letters.
Well, but her email told the story of who was right, didn't it?
See, you don't have to say it, Larry. We know what happened. You don't have to say it. No one ever has to self-edify.
So, well, I'm so disgusted by this, and I appreciate that she was able to send that email to me. I'm sad that I was not able to have more impact before we got to this point, but I'm glad to get the email affirming that I was telling her the truth.
So our medic says it can be life-threatening. It damages the liver, heart, particularly if it's not treated. And he says, he's hosed. That's not cool, man. I guess then competent attorneys would somehow, I don't know how you just randomly ask, does he have this condition? Hemochromatosis or whatever? And, yes, of course I have that. But somehow that would come out by looking at medical documents. Oh, what is your normal schedule? Yes, I have to go to the shot place every week or so to have my blood removed. And then, hey, judge, this person's in a life-threatening situation. If he doesn't keep up with this medical stuff, here's my medical expert stand on the stand with a statement to prevent this kid from going to prison like this. Is that how that works?
Well, I would have tried that if everything else failed. I would have tried everything. This is a tragedy. I mean, I doubt he's going to get the pillow pet. What do you think?
He's going to have to use his normal pillow. He may end up to be somebody's pillow pet.
So it's a tragedy.
I hope mom's not listening. Mom, don't listen. I'm really just being over the top gross. Yeah. And how did you, so she contacted you from NARSL? I'm just trying to backtrack over if there's any questions I missed.
No, we've covered it, and it was through NARSL, and I'm going to call her this evening before it gets too late and see if we can go over the limited options, but the options now are very limited.
Because you sign away your right to an appeal by doing this.
Correct. And I told her they were going to do that. I said they're going to read a whole bunch of things, rights he's surrendering, and they're going to ask him, does he understand he's surrendering these rights? And I said, this is going to happen this way. And you know, now she realizes that he's, the only thing we can file now is likely a habeas. And that's a long shot. Everything we can do now is a very long shot, just like it was with that Texas, the guy from Texas.
Are there any angles to pressure the prison system in general to handle his medical condition?
Not to come to mind. I've never served any time in a prison setting, but I don't know what you do. I mean, the Bureau of Prisons is inadequate, and they have more money than most state systems. I can't imagine that West Virginia is going to have a good medical system. They probably have it privatized, and I doubt that they take care of people, because the private sector does it better than government. You understand that?
I've heard that before. And not going to be, since these guys are telling me that this can lead to diabetes, that I was, when I was in the Army, somebody went into diabetic shock, whatever, his blood sugar dropped, and he freaking face planted. And I'm just wondering, like, that would be the level that you would have to achieve for them to pay attention to you, and you're having a seizure on the ground, that they would be like, oh, maybe we should possibly consider taking care of this.
Even that doesn't work sometimes, because they think you're faking. So it's,
oh, it's especially terrible when you're young.
Yep. So,
all right. I don't have anything else here, man.
And I don't either, but I'll report back next week after I've had conversations with her.
All right. Well, I have a couple final things that I wanted to, we have a lot of YouTube stuff going on now, because I've started releasing shorts. They're getting a really high number of views, which is, I don't know, interesting, exciting, something like that. And one of our longtime listeners, he posted a question, and he says, going back to the previous episode of the guy being pulled off the plane, that's the context that we're going to talk about here. And his question is, there has to be more to the story about the guy getting pulled from the plane, because a PFR reported travel but was less than 21 days. Also, some states may not report travel if they are not AWA compliant.
Yes, but in this particular instance, the state did require that the information be provided. So he had signed to that effect that he knew he was obligated to report international travel. But there's certainly more to this case that we don't know, and we're basically teasing with this closing question the episode that we're putting together on interstate international travel, because I still can't figure out how you would go to France, even if it's one way, without traveling. I'm boggled and befuddled by how you would do that. It doesn't say, in the way I read the language, it doesn't say if you're making a round trip internationally. It says if you're traveling internationally. And I don't know how you would travel to France how would you get to Paris without traveling? I'm totally dumb.
Teleportation? So, Star Trek transporters?
So it seems like to me that it's really confusing. And then we got a comment from a listener in New York. He sent a copy of their documentation, and they don't require it be a round trip. They require all international travel be reported. So it's mind-boggling that California takes the position, if you're not returning, then we just deregister you and you just go and have a great life. That's funny.
I want to say that the guy that from Indiana that was at the conference who went to Germany, that's, I think he did his 21 days, but I'm kind of thinking that, like, they just deregistered and said peace out, because, like, if they're going to tell you when you get there, make sure you register with their office or whatever, and you never plan on coming back, what are they going to do? Come get you?
I guess I'm not completely understanding it. If you tell them you're going to France or Egypt or wherever, if Egypt doesn't have a PFR registry, you could at least contact California and say, I'm in Egypt now. You can close whatever loop you've got open, and I can confirm I'm in Egypt, but I don't have to register here. And it seems like that would be the minimum they would require, would be some confirmation that you made it to the international destination. Otherwise, you could be freely roaming the United States as an unregistered, deregistered person, and that would not be within the intent of the law.
I gotcha. And then last but not least, I said I announced a new patron last week by the name of Jason, and he also sent along this comment. I just got out of prison a year ago, and I'm currently on PRC in Ohio. What is PRC?
No idea.
Prison release. Whatever. Someone in Ohio tell me, maybe. This podcast has helped me feel part of a community, although sometimes depressed because of who? Larry. Thanks, Larry. I'm looking forward to contributing to the discussion as well. Thank you. You've inspired me to get involved. So thank you very much for that comment, Jason. That's really awesome. And yes, Larry is Mr. Doom and Gloom. Don't forget it. But he does tell you the truth. Sadly, that's the reality, is that he is sadly right. I'm sure there's a better way to word that too. Anything before we go, Larry?
No. Peace out.
Peace out. Hey, make sure you head over to fypeducation.org/shop. We have been adding new merch there. And yes, I just got reminded to mention the merch as I was mentioning the merch. But yeah, we've got new t-shirts and other logo designs up there, and I keep working on different ones. So please head over there. And if interested, we're going to add like mouse pads and tumblers and stickers and all kinds of stuff. So please go over there and help support us. And otherwise, show notes are over at registrymatters.co. Leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. RegistryMattersCast@gmail.com. If you want me to send nasty grams over to Larry, I will forward them rapidly. And then please, as I said earlier, head over to patreon.com/registrymatters to support the program for as little as $1 a month. And that is fantastic and appreciated. If nothing else, Larry, I hope you have a fantastic weekend with your cat. And I will see everybody later. Have a great night, Larry.
Good night.
Alrighty then.
You've been listening to FYP.